We'll hear argument now in number 86, 1128, Immigration and Naturalization Service versus Asibi Abudu. Mr. Klonoff, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case raises the issue of when a reviewing court can compel the immigration authorities to reopen a deportation proceeding for an evidentiary hearing after the alien has already been given a hearing and after an order of deportation has been entered. The context in which the issue arises is as follows. Respondent has been here illegally for almost 12 years, since 1976. His deportation hearing was held in 1982 and involved five appearances before the immigration judge between 1981 and 1982. Respondent, who was represented by competent counsel at the hearing, declined to seek asylum despite specific questioning by the immigration judge on the issue. In 1985, respondent filed a motion to reopen to apply for asylum and withholding of deportation based on an event that occurred in 1984, namely a visit to respondent by a Ghanaian official who was also respondent's personal friend. And I will have more to say about this event later in the argument. The issue of the extent of deference in the context of a motion to reopen has been addressed by this Court three times in the immigration context, in Zhang Ha Wang, in Rios Pineda, and in Finpathia. These cases emphasize the great deference that must be given to the Board of Immigration Appeals in its decision not to reopen. The Court has emphasized the importance of finality, and has pointed out that in this context, reopening is not required by statute, but is purely a product of regulation. And in fact, the regulation itself does not mandate reopening in any particular circumstance, but rather, as the Court noted, is framed in the negative.
Mr. Klonoff, then reopening is not a procedure provided for by statute?
That's correct. It is purely a matter of regulation. And this Court has made that clear in Zhang Ha Wang. In its discussion. Notwithstanding this Court's decisions, the Ninth Circuit held, contrary to the BIA, that respondent had alleged a prima facie case of eligibility for asylum and that an evidentiary hearing was therefore required. As a result of the Ninth Circuit's holding, the entire process will begin anew, including possible appeals, even though the deportation hearing was held more than 5 years ago, and even though the only fact that was offered by respondent in support of his motion to reopen is one that even the Ninth Circuit itself said could be viewed as ambiguous or benign. Now, if I could just elaborate briefly on some of the facts that are critical to this case. As I said, respondent entered the United States originally in 1965, approximately 10 years ago. He left briefly during the summer of 1973 and then returned on a visa that was good until 1976. In 1981, while respondent was here illegally, he pleaded guilty to three narcotics offenses. And based on his plea of guilty to those offenses, the Immigration and Naturalization Service instituted deportation proceedings. And those proceedings, in fact, resulted in hearings that occurred between November and July, November 1981, July 1982. There were five separate appearances, the continuances on each occasion being at respondent's request. One of the continuances in the case from November 10, 1981 to January 11, 1982, appears to have been requested in part so that respondent could prepare an application for asylum and withholding of deportation. And in fact, respondent's counsel specifically represented to the immigration judge that such an application would be filed. Respondent ultimately chose not to seek asylum or withholding of deportation, and he was consequently found deportable in July 1982. And that decision was affirmed by the BIA in 1984. In February 1985, while that appeal was pending in the Ninth Circuit, respondent filed a motion to reopen with the Board of Immigration Appeals. As respondent concedes, the only new fact that relates to the respondent, other than just the general events in Ghana, was this visit from the Ghanaian official. And it's significant to note that although this visit occurred in the spring of 1984, respondent waited almost an entire year until February 1985 before seeking reopening. And there's no dispute that this individual who made the visit is someone who respondent had known for many years. The additional facts,
Mr.
which...
Mr. Klonoff, is that new evidence not available before within the meaning of the regulation, do you suppose?
Probably was not. Since the deportation hearing occurred in 1982 and since the visit did not occur until 1984, this was new evidence. We have a serious dispute with the Ninth Circuit's conclusion that it was material evidence.
So you think it was new evidence not available before, but
that's
take the position that it just wasn't material.
That's exactly correct. The old facts, which were in existence at the time respondent chose not to apply for asylum, essentially involved allegations involving his brother and other close associates in terms of their associations with prior regimes in Ghana and the fact that those individuals may well be in danger. It is important to note, as the BIA pointed out in its opinion, the respondent doesn't explain how the risk to those individuals would necessarily translate into a risk to respondent. Respondent now concedes.
But didn't that become clearer when this man came over from Ghana?
Well, we don't think so. We're not sure what import ought to be given.
I'm not sure either, but could be argued, couldn't it? It was quite obvious that he was trying to get him back there for one purpose only.
Well, we don't think that's obvious, Justice.
Well, what is the other reason?
Well, the reason
that a man would spend that amount of money to come over here.
Oh, but it's certainly there's no allegation in the motion to reopen that this man came for the sole purpose of visiting respondent. And in fact, he didn't even know where to locate respondent and it had to contact respondent through his brother. The more reasonable inference is that he was here for another purpose, perhaps an official government purpose, and decided to contact the respondent. That's one of the ambiguities, in fact, in the evidence.
You mean they're trying to kill his whole family, but they're going to bring him back and let him live?
Well, we don't know if they're trying to kill his whole family. All we know...
The testimony.
Well, there was no testimony. The only reference to the brother were very brief statements in the motion to reopen, a one-line sentence indicating that the brother's house had previously been surrounded, and then a vague allegation that the brother had made his way out of Ghana. But let me respond.
And was still out and was still wanted.
According to the conclusory allegation, with no explanation as to why. But let me respond, Justice Marshall, to your...
Well, the way to get around and find out whether conclusory allegations are correct is one way only. And that's to hold a hearing.
Well, we would...
Isn't that right?
Well, we don't
Isn't
think
that
so.
Right?
We don't think so. We think that the purpose of an evidentiary hearing is not to give the alien an opportunity to flesh out the motion to reopen. It's not a preview of things to come. We think that the purpose of the evidentiary hearing is to see if respondent can prove the facts that he alleges in the motion to reopen. And let me give you an example in the criminal context, in the context of a motion for a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence. Every court would agree that it's inadequate for a defendant to come in after trial and say, I have found a new witness who's going to exonerate me. I'm not going to tell you all the details now, but if you give me a new trial and you vacate my conviction, we'll tell you all about it. That's simply not the proper way to go about it. The case law was clear at the time in every circuit. The respondent needed to lay out in detail exactly what his theory was, or he would risk denial of the motion to reopen on the ground that it was conclusory. But let me, Justice Marshall, get back to your original question, because there is a very important reason why this individual may have wanted the respondent to return to Ghana. And that's because he was a medical doctor who was trained in the United States, was highly educated. And in fact, respondent's own evidence in the motion to reopen indicates that the prior Ghanaian regimes had also tried very, very hard to get respondent back. He was highly sought after regardless of the regime in power. And we don't think that there's anything that can be viewed.
History hadn't.
I'm sorry?
They had kept up with the doctor and what he was doing and all?
Well, we don't know. Apparently not, because the visitor didn't know where he
was
located.
That's what I was saying. So why do they want him back if they don't know where he is?
Well, we think that, as I said, this is a situation. You have a developing country.
One way or the other.
Admitted. That's correct. And consequently, it's the kind of fact that cries out for additional facts before an individual would have a well-founded fear. Or certainly, at least, Given the ambiguity of the fact, given the colloquy that we've had right now, it seems to me quite clear that this is simply not enough for the extraordinary remedy of reopening a deportation proceeding 5 years later in a situation in which the individual has already been found deportable, has already had a full opportunity to assert his claim for asylum and chose not to do so. The Board of Immigration Appeals, in its holding, held, number one, that respondent did not adequately explain his failure to apply for asylum and withholding during the deportation hearing, and that consequently he failed to comply with the regulatory requirements. HCFR 208.11 specifically requires that an alien give an adequate explanation. Secondly, the board held that the new fact, as alleged by respondent, was ambiguous, just as we've recognized here today. It could be viewed as benign, but it could be viewed as threatening. And when you have a fact like that that could be viewed so many different ways, it's not the kind of fact that would compel the immigration authorities to reopen for a deportation hearing. The Ninth Circuit reversed and remanded the case for an evidentiary hearing.
Excuse me, is it at least the kind of fact that establishes a prima facie case?
We don't think it is. As I said, and again, this is just to dovetail the question that was asked by Justice Marshall, we agree with the definition of prima facie case given by the Ninth Circuit on page 7A of the petitioner's appendix, that it's a case in which where the affidavits or other evidentiary materials, if true, would satisfy the requirements for substantive relief. So we don't view a prima facie case as being enough to show that a hearing might be useful.
Well, then wait a minute. He had a conclusory allegation, as you say, and he had, in addition, a fact to support that, which you claim was ambiguous. Now, that may not be enough to carry the day, but isn't that enough to establish a prima facie case?
We don't think it is. We think that what a prima facie case means is that if he came in and proved everything that he alleged, he would be entitled to the relief, or at least would have established eligibility for the relief. And again, that's how the Ninth Circuit itself uses prima facie case. We don't think, if it were true that a prima facie case was somehow less, that only required you to somehow get in the door or provide a non-frivolous case, then in almost every situation, it would be very difficult for the board to say this is not enough, because the existence of even
that's just one of the conditions. I mean, it isn't as though the only thing standing before the board and reopening is the prima facie case requirement. There are other requirements, as you're urging upon us, right?
Well, that is true, and as we've argued, we believe it's quite clear that the board was within its discretion in denying reopening on the separate ground that the explanation was inadequate.
Do the regulations in any way define what a prima facie case is?
They do not, Chief Justice.
So then it's really up to the BIA to determine what a prima facie case is?
That's exactly right. And there's really no dispute here about prima facie case. I don't think the Ninth Circuit was applying the test in the manner suggested by Justice Scalia, where it's simply enough to show that you might be able to prove a case. We think a prima facie case means, if the facts as alleged could be proved at an evidentiary hearing, would you be eligible for the relief? The Ninth Circuit, we think is quite significant, simply ignored one of the two grounds relied upon by the BIA. The Ninth Circuit didn't even address the issue of whether respondent had met the regulatory requirement, 208.11, in his adequate explanation. We think that that ground alone is basis for reversal. In addition, we submit...
May I ask, I'm a little puzzled now about what the exact issue is. Do you think we have to decide whether the motion to reopen states a prima facie case or not?
Not technically, the court doesn't have to reach that issue. The case could be reversed solely on the ground that respondent did not meet the regulatory requirements for reopening. One thing that's important to point out is that even the Ninth Circuit did not decide that there was a prima facie case for withholding.
In other words, are you arguing that because he didn't meet the regulatory requirements for failing to explain why he didn't make the point earlier, that ends the case, and we don't even have to look at the motion?
That very well could end the case. That is a separate and independent
ground.
Is
that your principal submission, or what is your principal submission?
Well,
I have a little difficulty with
there are two grounds. This case is quite analogous to Zhang Ha Wang, in which the court reached both the regulatory requirement issue and the prima facie case issue.
You don't have to reach both, do you?
You don't have to. That is correct.
My question is, which is your principal claim? What are you really asking us to decide?
Our principal concern deals with the way the court analyzed and came to the conclusion that there was a prima facie case, the standard that has to be applied. One approach for this court would be to rule on those two points.
I understand. We have alternative ways of doing it. I'm trying to find out what you are, if you could write the opinion, what would you say in the opinion? You could put it on one ground only.
The one ground would be that the Ninth Circuit improperly second-guessed the BIA's holding that there was no prima facie case, and it did so for two reasons.
So that you mainly want us to decide whether the motion states a prima facie case. That's what you're really saying, is that?
Well,
and if
to
that's
decide
true,
whether,
I don't even find the motion in the papers before me.
The motion is there, Justice Stevens. We submitted a lodging with the clerk, which has the entire motion to reopen. But
it's not in the printed materials.
No, because we had already...
Isn't there a joint appendix with it in it?
This was a substitute for the joint appendix. We had filed a motion to waive the printing. We thought that particularly...
At that time, you apparently didn't think we'd need even read the motion.
Well, no, that was not true. We felt that because the entire administrative record was reproduced in this volume, and since we had already submitted it to the clerk, counsel did not oppose that. Obviously, the court may well wish to read the motion to reopen.
We have to read it to decide your theory of the case.
Where does the term prima facie case come in here? It's not in the regulations. It's not in the statute. Does the BIA use it in its opinions?
It does. The history of that was discussed in Wang. There were two cases in which the BIA stated that a prima facie case is a requirement for a motion to reopen, and this court noted that in Zhang Ha Wang and, in fact, has reaffirmed those requirements.
So that's really its interpretation, then, of the applicable regulations.
That's correct. That's correct. And the board, of course, would be, we submit, entitled to deference. And if I could follow up on Justice Stevens' question, this court doesn't necessarily have to reach the final issue of whether or not there's a prima facie case. What the court could decide is that the Ninth Circuit applied the erroneous standard in analyzing the issue and simply send the case back. We would urge the court to reach the issue. But let me explain the two points.
Well, let me ask, while we're trying to decide what we have on our plate here, Even assuming that we disagreed with you and thought the Ninth Circuit was correct on the prima facie case point and on ignoring the regulatory requirements, do you concede then that if they were right about that, the proper relief that the Ninth Circuit should have afforded was to require a reopening?
We don't concede that at
because
all.
Because those regulatory requirements and the prima facie case are conditions to a reopening, but there's nothing that I know of that says that if you meet those, there must be a reopening.
That's absolutely correct, and in fact, I would
So that's another piece on our plate. We could go off on that ground, too.
That's correct, and in that regard, Justice Scalia, I would ask the Court to look at page 20A, footnote 2 of the petitioner's appendix, which points out that another ground that the Board did not decide but could have would be the impact of this individual's criminal convictions. The Board could have decided here that this individual, as a matter of discretion, did not merit asylum and therefore that reopening could be denied without an evidentiary hearing. So that, again, is another ground. There was simply no warrant for the Ninth Circuit to jump to the conclusion that an evidentiary hearing was appropriate. The Court of Appeals adopted two principles that enabled it to reach the conclusion that respondent had made a prima facie case. The first was it held that in ruling on when a court of appeals rules on the issue of whether there's a prima facie case, it considers the issue de novo. The agency is not given any deference whatsoever in its judgment. The second point that the Ninth Circuit held in reviewing these cases is that when the board reviews a motion to reopen, it has to give the alien all inferences or all benefits of the doubt. It was only by A, reviewing the case de novo, and B, reading every inference in the alien's favor that even the Ninth Circuit was able to hold that there was a prima facie case. And we would submit that if this court disagrees on those two points, we think it necessarily follows that there's no prima facie case. If the board is not required, for example, to draw the inferences in the alien's favor. If I could just very briefly discuss why it is that we disagree with the
May
court.
I ask one other question about the prima facie case. When this was before the Board of Immigration Appeals, had we decided Cardozo-Fonseca yet?
No, the court had not. However,
so they had the case at a time when the law was somewhat unclear as to what the prima facie case might be.
Well, that is correct, except let me note a number of points in that regard. First of all, on page 19A of the petitioner's appendix, in the board's opinion, the board cites the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Cardozo-Fonseca, which was affirmed by this court. We would submit that the board understood the difference between the standards and applied it here. There is nothing in the opinion to suggest that the board was applying the same standard here. And a couple of other points are quite significant in that regard. As we've noted in our reply brief, in the Court of Appeals, respondent clearly indicated, I believe it was page 28 of his Court of Appeals brief, that he had no objection whatsoever to the legal principles applied by the BIA. We noted in our Court of Appeals brief that in our interpretation of the BIA's opinion, the BIA was correctly applying the lower standard for asylum. We made that quite clear in our brief, and respondent in his reply brief never challenged that. And the Court of Appeals never questioned the fact that the Ninth Circuit, or the fact that the Board of Immigration Appeals understood and was applying a lower standard for asylum. So we would submit that that's simply not an issue in this case. If I could make a few points as to why we disagree on the de novo review point. First of all, as I have noted, this court has made clear on several occasions that it is not appropriate for the court to engage in de novo review in these contexts. Rios-Pineda could not have been clearer in stating that it is not the function of a court to review the Attorney General's decisions de novo. That was at 471 U.S. at page 452.
Yes, but that was a decision after a hearing, wasn't it? It wasn't a review of a pleading. Or was it?
There's
a difference between reviewing whether a pleading is sufficient to state a cause of action or prima facie on the one hand, and reviewing whether the evidence made out a case on the other.
Rios-Pineda was also a question where the lower court had ordered that a case be sent back for an evidentiary hearing.
There had been no evidentiary hearing before.
I don't believe there had been, and this court said that there did not need to be because the board had denied relief to the aliens as a matter of discretion. And there are numerous the same thing is true in Zhang Ha Wang, by the way. There was not a hearing. The Ninth Circuit held that even though no affidavits had been submitted, that the alien had made out a prima facie case that required a hearing. And again, the court held that no evidentiary hearing was required. That same circumstance, by the way, is present in numerous Court of Appeals cases. We've cited cases from circuits throughout the country involving a situation exactly like this, in which there's a motion to reopen alleging prima facie eligibility for asylum and withholding of deportation. And the courts of appeals prior to this case have unanimously held that under this court's decisions in Rios-Pineda and Zhang Ha Wang, the decision on whether or not there's a prima facie case for reopening is one that must be given deference to the administrative agency. And that's all we're asking for here. The Ninth Circuit has held.
Let me just also get something straight. A prima facie case for reopening, in other words, is a different It's something different from a prima facie case for eligibility for withholding of deportation or asylum.
No, it's the same thing.
Is it the same? The same facts would if facts A, B, and C, without an original claim, would constitute a prima facie case for a claim of asylum. That would also constitute a prima facie case for reopening after?
Well, as Justice Scalia correctly pointed out, the fact that you allege a prima facie case does not mean you're entitled to a hearing. It just means that you've met one of the requirements that the board has set out for a hearing. The board has not said that a hearing is required in any circumstance, however. And again, I would point out, even if a prima facie case had been alleged, the board held that its regulatory requirements had not been met for a different reason.
You keep using the word deference. Do you mean that a decision of the BIA on the question of a prima facie case is unappealable?
No, we don't mean that, Justice
Marshall.
Well,
what do you mean by deference?
What we mean is that the Court of Appeals should not substitute its judgment for that of the immigration authorities. If reasonable minds could differ, if the board's opinion is a reasonable analysis of the evidence, then it must be affirmed. If the board's opinion makes no sense whatsoever, if there's something egregiously wrong about it, then obviously there's a role for the court to play. We're not arguing that it's totally unreviewable, and we don't think that the court has to reach that issue. It's really the difference between how the circuits other than this case have approached the issue and how this court approaches the issue. This court says that the inquiry is whether or not the board's assessment is correct.
What you mean by us using deference?
Deference means, in our view,
abandonment.
No, it just means, that, as generally in administrative law, that there ought to be weight given to the administrative agency's views. And even if the court independently...
Well, can I give weight to them and rule against them?
Only if the decision... You could, but only if the decision is so extreme as to be unreasonable. If the decision could reasonably go either way, we think that the role of the court is to simply affirm.
Mr. Klonoff, I have one. Let me. I have a problem with deference to a judgment about a prima facie case or not. I mean, it's one thing. It's one thing to say that on the ultimate question, the ultimate fact finding, you go along with the agency if there's substantial evidence. Reasonable minds could go either way, and therefore you let the agency go the way it wants, so long as it's reasonable. But the whole notion of a prima facie case is rock bottom. It means a reasonable mind. If the phrase means anything, it means a reasonable mind could find for somebody on these allegations, giving them the benefit of the doubt.
We don't think
interpreting
that's...
doubts in favor of the person making the allegations. Isn't that what a prima facie case means? And then to say you're sort of applying a reasonableness standard to a reasonableness standard. It's once removed. I don't know.
But our point is, again, we do not disagree with the definition of prima facie used by the court. The question is whether or not the court can simply ignore what the agency has done and decide independently whether there's enough or whether it has to give deference, as we've said, to what the agency has said. And as I've indicated, every circuit that has analyzed this issue has explained that the agency's view has to be given great weight in this context.
Is it any different from in civil cases? We defer to the fact finders, let's say a case tried to a judge. We defer to the judge's findings of fact. Unless there's no reasonable basis for them, we accept them. But do we defer to the trial judge's determination that summary judgment could be granted?
Where the court does defer.
Do we? Do we say, well, you know, maybe summary judgment could be granted, maybe it couldn't. It's a close question. We defer to the trial. We don't do that. Summary judgment is rock bottom, and so it seems to me is prima facie case.
We think the better analogy is a reopening for an administrative hearing or a motion for a new trial in either a civil or a criminal case. And there the courts repeatedly give great weight or deference to what the agency.
Not to fact-finding, though. You're reducing — we defer to them because we defer to their judgment about whether they want to reopen or not. You're asking us to defer to a fact-finding about whether there is a prima facie case or not. I'm perfectly willing to defer to the board's determination that it doesn't want to reopen for policy reasons, for whatever else. But you're asking us not to defer to that. You're asking us to defer to their determination that there was or was not a prima facie case. And that seems to me like deferring to a district judge's determination that there was enough evidence or was not enough evidence to grant summary judgment.
Well, we think it's more like deferring to a court's determination that the newly discovered evidence isn't enough to warrant a new trial. And there is substantial deference. If there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Klonoff. Mrs. Harper, well, Ms. Harper, we'll hear from you now.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it may please the Court. We would like to first state our view of what the Ninth Circuit did in this case. When we look at the finding of the Circuit Court, we remember basic rules, basic things that we were supposed to be studying in law school, the approach to a case, the approach to resolving a conflict. In Pullman Standard versus Swint, this court did make references to this in the context of discussing where there are mixed questions of law and fact. The approach that was discussed, and which we remember from those days, three steps. First, there's the establishing of the historical facts. Second, there is selecting the applicable rule of law. And third is applying the rule of law to the established facts. In the prima facie case test, however, I think one goes through the same steps. But at the first step of establishing the historical evidentiary facts, in the traditional prima facie case test, the adjudicator of the test does not determine the facts. He or she accepts the facts that have been offered.
Ms. Harper, that may well be true in the context of, say, a motion to dismiss under the rules of civil procedure, or the analog in the rules of criminal procedure. But why should the BIA be governed by that kind of a strict legal mode that we allege certain things, and then if there's a contest, we have a hearing?
Mr. Justice, we believe that is because the BIA chose the prima facie case test, this is not in the regulations, as came out in the earlier discussion. When the Attorney General made the regulations, he did not state in what instance motions to reopen should be granted. The Board of Immigration Appeals in 1972, in the case of N. Ray Cypus, said, ordinarily we would grant reopening if this person would have given us a prima facie case. And it's our view that because the board selected, it wasn't imposed upon the board by the courts. They voluntarily selected prima facie case, a term that has general meaning, that they should.
And you think it must be analyzed just as if we were in a federal district court on a motion to dismiss with the rules of civil procedure?
No, I don't think four square exactly on all of the federal rules of civil procedure. No, Mr. Justice, I certainly don't, because we're not talking about exactly the same thing. I'm talking about the underlying principle. I'm talking about the basics of what a prima facie case is and the basic approach in any context of deciding if there has been a prima facie case. But I'm not arguing federal rules of civil procedure.
Well, Ms. Harper, do you think that at bottom, in this immigration setting, that the BIA has discretion to decide whether to grant someone status to remain or not, and discretion to decide whether to grant rehearing or not?
Madam Justice, I think the Board of Immigration Appeals certainly can exercise its discretion in the discretionary aspect of the case, but in this case they didn't. They did not address or examine any discretionary factors. I don't think that the standard, as announced by this.
I think that if the BIA decides to deny rehearing, that could be an exercise of discretion?
If the BIA denies, period, without announcing a standard, simply, in essence, if you will, we just don't want to hear this one today, that's arbitrary. And even if it is discretion, it is an arbitrary exercise of discretion.
Well, yes, certainly it could be, but you're not arguing that that was the situation here.
No, we're arguing that the Board of Immigration Appeals chose not to examine the discretionary factors, chose not to exercise that discretion, which it has. Instead, it chose to make the decision that there had not been a prima facie case shown, and that is the finding that was reviewed. The Ninth Circuit did also review and made very brief reference to the establishing of new facts. If we very carefully examine the BIA decision, we find that the manner in which they interpreted chose to determine, and the manner in which they did determine the motive of the caller from the Ghanaian government was the fact that led to their conclusion that this was not, that there had not been a sufficient explanation. The Board of Immigration Appeals said, we don't think that by itself this visit sufficiently explains failure to raise this earlier. And when the Ninth Circuit found that they had determined a fact they shouldn't have determined and that the facts should be interpreted otherwise, then it became an explanation. That answered the question. Then there was reference to that in the circuit court opinion. It was not a lengthy reference because it did sort of emerge as self-proving fact. It is our opinion that when we look at these steps in resolving the prima facie case test, we find that what the Ninth Circuit said here basically was, you determined a fact when you weren't supposed to determine it. You went wrong on the first step. The circuit court did not go on to examine the application of the selection of the correct rule of law as applies to the refugee law. The circuit court did not do an examination of the application of the law to the facts. Now, this is the area where, if there is discretion, deference, to be given to the BIA, it would be in the last area of applying the facts to the law. And this was not examined by the circuit court. What they examined was, what they found to be the error was the very first step. You were supposed to accept the facts and not decide them. We talk about the prima facie case test, where it came from, the regulations, where they came from. It is respondent's position that this must begin with an analysis of what Congress did in refugee law. And prior cases have been before this court dealing with immigration cases. This has been probably the central lesson, the common lesson. We look at what Congress has done in the area. That was done in Wang, it was done in Pinpatha, it was done in Stebic, it was done in Cardoza, Fonseca.
Well, of course, Congress didn't provide for rehearing motions at all.
No, that is correct, Madam Justice. But what Congress did, Congress mandated that the Attorney General shall provide a procedure for aliens to apply for asylum irrespective of status. Dr. Abudu's status was a deportable alien. Irrespective of status, he has the right, or should have an opportunity to apply. Now, they didn't say reopening, but Congress not only considered changes of circumstances, Congress wrote changes of circumstances into the law, into the refugee law. Subsection B of the section 208A provides that if you are granted asylum status and you lose your status as a refugee, your asylum status is terminated. Throughout, they talk of refugee status. You have to have refugee status to be eligible to apply. You lose your asylum status if you lose the refugee status. In the following section, section 209 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, after you've been in a refugee or asylum status for 1 year, you may apply to become a permanent resident. But you must also show that you have not lost your refugee status. Congress, and they use the word, they include the phrase change of circumstances. If Congress foresaw that people would lose asylum status, not be able to become permanent residents because of changes of circumstances, certainly Congress also foresaw that one would acquire refugee status because of change of circumstances and would qualify upon events that occurred after they came into the country and after various events may have happened to change their status. Pardon?
But Congress did not do it. Congress left it to the Attorney General.
Yes.
Well, I don't understand your argument at all. They left it to the Attorney General. They could have taken it over.
I'm sorry, Mr. Justice. Would you repeat that, Mr. Justice?
I said Congress could have said it can be reopened.
Yes.
Instead, Congress said the Attorney General shall decide whether it can be reopened.
I agree somewhat, Mr. Justice. They certainly did not say that it should be reopened. They left it up to the Attorney General to devise procedures. And the Attorney General devised procedures, including procedures for reopening. And these procedures for reopening were followed in this case. And incidentally, counsel would like at this point to point out a little correction. I understand that in preparing these cases, the government is certainly no different from I, and they make mistakes. But this is where we said we have no problems with the principles of the law. In our brief to the Ninth Circuit on page 28, discussing the regulations for reopening, 8 CFR 208.11 requires the alien to reasonably explain failure to request asylum prior to the completion of deportation, citation, and then we go on to say we have no quarrel with the principles of law. This is where we have no quarrel, and we have no quarrel with the regulations. We believe these regulations are proper. It's simply our position that we complied with the regulations. We respect them. Dr. Abudu played by the rules. He didn't bring his case when the law, as it was being interpreted at that time, together with the facts, would not support all of the elements necessary for the claim. The government now says, well, now that your case is ripened, your case should be, reopening should be denied because you didn't bring it when it was premature. This is...
May I ask, are you in effect conceding that if there had not been the visit by this gentleman from Ghana after, you know, that you use as a basis for the new evidence of well-founded, without that visit you would not state a prima facie case for reopening?
Under the law, and as it was when he was before the immigration judge in 1982, it would not have met the requirements at that time. At this time, it is the visit.
And what is the change of law that you rely on?
Pardon?
How is the law different than it was in 1982?
This court addressed the distinctions between clear probability, well-founded fear in the Stevie case. Now, that case, I'm well aware, of course, that was not the case that made the definitive ruling on well-founded fear. But when this court spoke in Stevie, those of us out there on the front lines trying to bring justice to our clients saw hope. We saw rays of hope that there was, in fact, a ground, that we had a sound legal basis to, in good faith, advance our theories that a well-founded fear was different. Therefore, what we would have brought in 1985 is quite different from what we would bring in 1982. We didn't have the solid law, but this court had spoken and had given some guidance, we felt, in dictum. And as there also had been decisions in the circuit courts that were beginning to develop. But to answer your question, yes, it was the visit which created gave the last of the elements that we believe clearly puts the case within the prima facie case test.
What about the regulatory requirements, Ms. Harper? Why were they met here?
The regulatory requirements were met by virtue of the fact the events that provided the objective evidence that this man's fear is reasonable didn't even happen until after deportation proceedings were concluded. That, of course, meant that it met a twofold requirement. One, it met the requirement of new material, and two, in and of itself, it explains why he didn't bring it in 1982, because it hadn't happened in 1982. Also, I'd like to just briefly mention, and I understand this record can get a little confusing, all of these continuances and how long this case has been going on. November 10, 1981 was when Dr. Abudu first stood before the immigration judge and he said, "I'm afraid to go back to Ghana." November 10, 1981, according to the record, and I understand there was somewhat of a problem here, but on that date, he was appearing on what we call a master calendar, sort of like an arraignment or a plea court, and his attorney announced that they would be disputing, they were not conceding deportability. So the case was set for hearing. It was not set for the first, was not continued to give him an opportunity to file asylum. He was told, well, then it will have to set it at a time when we have more time to hear the issues on the issue of deportability. That's why it was continued the first time. It was set for another date. That is on page 45 of volume 1 of the record. The second time they went in, ready to contest and go over the issue of deportability, and the government was there with a new charge. So here was something new that had to be answered.
Ms. Harper, let's come back to the regulatory requirements. This visit by Al-Hassan, It isn't just that this was new evidence demonstrating a need for asylum that had been asserted earlier. He had never asserted a need for asylum earlier. He had never even claimed that he was going to be persecuted if he went back in the earlier hearing. It isn't that this was a new piece of evidence to support a prior claim. What he was asking the board to believe is that he had no reason whatever to believe he was going to be persecuted until this visit by Al-Hassan occurred. That alone is enough to explain why he never raised the asylum request before. Is the board really compelled to accept that as a reasonable proposition?
Mr. Justice, I think this again goes back to the problem with the record. On the November 10 hearing, when asked to if you are, it's a standard part of the procedure to be asked if you are to have to be deported, what country would you wish to be deported to? And he named first Canada, was told he couldn't name Canada, then he named England. And he said, and the judge said, do you feel your life or freedom would be threatened in Ghana on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or of a political opinion? Answer from Dr. Abudu. I can say my life, yes. On which of these grounds? Political opinion. This is all that was said. At that time, he asserted his fear. The first
But test, didn't claim asylum.
He did not make an actual application. He did not pursue an application.
So he comes to the board now and he says, the one enormous thing that has, it's not just an additional piece of evidence, but what has made me change my mind about whether I need asylum or not, is this possibly innocuous visit by Al-Hassan. The board really must reopen because of that and must believe that that one event is what suddenly changed this man from a person who didn't need asylum to one that did.
Yes, if we examine what
And it's Al-Hassan, irrational to conclude otherwise.
Yes, Mr. Justice, I believe so. If we examine the elements of the case, in 1981, when he first went before the judge, the government in Ghana was in shaky condition. It was still being led, at least figuratively, by Dr. Abudu's brother and friends. 2 months later, they were ousted in a violent coup, and Flight Lieutenant Rawlings took over the government. Dr. Abudu is still in deportation proceedings. Dr. Abudu's friend, the Minister of State, was put in jail. His lifelong friend, Lieutenant Colonel Hamidou, was declared number one enemy, and his brother got out of the country and went into exile. That's what we have by the end of deportation proceedings. We do not have any evidence, and what we have today shows that none of this existed to show that the government of Ghana knew who Dr. Abudu was, knew where he was, that they were interested in him in any way, and he had not taken a stand against the government of Ghana. That's what was missing in 1982. And those were the elements that were
Didn't the doctor, through his counsel, affirmatively say in April that he did not intend to apply for asylum, even though he had previously said he did intend?
Yes, he did not intend to.
And he never submitted his...
And he did not file an application.
In the deportation proceeding, although he had been reminded many times that if he wanted to, he better do it. Isn't that right?
That is correct, Mr. Justice.
And so instead he said he just applied for an adjustment of status.
That is correct, Mr. Justice.
And so now the board has to reopen that proceeding because why?
Because he has stated new facts that were not in existence at that time that now support a case.
One fact.
The visit from the Ghanaian official combined with the fact that when this man came to see him, Dr. Abudu's brother and his lifelong friend, Lieutenant Colonel Hamidu, just the year before, had been named as suspects in a plot to overthrow the Ghanaian government on two separate occasions. Then, that was 83, 1 year after deportation proceedings. 84, somebody comes to see Dr. Abudu and wants to know about Lieutenant Colonel Hamidu. One fact by itself does not a case constitute. It is the stacking of the facts as they occur one after the other.
But you say one fact by itself requires the BIA to reopen.
If that fact adds the last of the needed ingredients for the case, yes, Mr. Justice. If that fact...
Even though there was no application for asylum previously.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
So how can you say the facts are stacked when the facts previously were never used as a basis to apply for asylum?
Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to, in response to that, I'd like to inquire and make a rhetorical question. Had he filed an application in 1982, what would have happened to it? Would it have been granted? We know by looking at the cases that it would not have been granted. We look at the precedent decisions. So where would he have been in 1984 with an application for asylum which had been denied that he wanted reopened for additional facts? What I'm saying, Mr. Chief Justice, is that I don't believe that our justice system, that our efficient running of the administrative and judicial system is served by requiring people to bring it. If it has any type of a remotely tolerable basis, bring it when you're in court. Because if you don't bring it when you're in court, we're going to deny you later. You know,
I agree with you on that. That seems to me quite reasonable, that if he didn't think he had a case then or a case that would be denied, we shouldn't penalize him for that. But the problem I'm having with your case is the assertion that this one fact does make so much of a difference. I mean, one might argue that it makes enough of a difference to just tip the scales. But the argument you're making to us is that it so clearly makes that difference that it is arbitrary.
Mr. I understand.
Ryan has to,
I understand,
not to allow it. That's a hard case.
But when we look at the elements, when we compare what happened in this one time in 1984, and we compare it to the elements, this visit is what let Dr. Abudu know, what gave him objective evidence of what he had felt, but you can't prove your case on what you feel. It gave him the objective evidence that the government of Ghana was interested in him. The government of Ghana wanted to talk to him.
But Ms. Harper, why can't the BIA hearing officer say, let's accept this statement and let's recognize that the visit has been made by the Ghanaian official? But even recognizing that, I don't think that's enough to justify granting rehearing. I don't think that's enough to change this person's status. Now, isn't there some leeway there for the BIA to take that position?
There was leeway to exercise discretion. They chose not to do it. Their decision has to rise or fall on the basis stated. I see my light, and in conclusion,
You have some time still, Ms. Harper. Don't panic. Assuming that you're right about the prima facie problem and assuming that you're right about the regulatory requirements, assuming, in short, that the Ninth Circuit was right on all of the points it decided, why was its proper action to direct an evidentiary hearing. Why shouldn't it have just remanded to have the board do it right next time? As
for
I understand it, there is no requirement in law that there be an evidentiary hearing. All that the Ninth Circuit decided is that the board gave the wrong reasons for denying an evidentiary hearing. But why could it command an evidentiary hearing? Where in the statute or even in the board's regulation does it say your client is entitled to an evidentiary hearing if he makes out a prima facie case and comes within the regulatory requirements? It's still within the board's discretion, isn't it?
The Board of Immigration Appeals has told us we would ordinarily grant, if you give us a prima facie case, we will grant reopening.
Where is that?
In Reyes Cipas, the first case that talked about the prima facie case. It's also mentioned in Matter of Garcia, which was cited by the American Immigration Lawyers Association in their amicus brief.
You're claiming it is the board's law that if you meet these two requirements, prima facie case and meet the regulatory requirements, you will get it?
They have stated this is what we want when we grant it. I don't wish to be misleading. I fully recognize that subsequent to that time there has been the modification of this court that the board may deny in the exercise of discretion. But the board gave us the test. They told us what they wanted, and we give them what they want. We present the facts that we believe are necessary to meet the prima facie case test. I would like to say that I think that Congress has told us what they've laid a narrow path for the Attorney General in refugee law. They have mandated that there be a procedure. The board has told us, the Attorney General gave us regulations, the board told us what they were looking for. And I think that all of these segments of the law.
What were you prepared to show at the hearing?
Pardon?
What were you prepared to put on in evidence at the hearing
additional,
if you had been granted a hearing?
Additional evidence?
What?
Possibly witnesses.
Not possibly. What you could do. Okay. What you had in hand ready to do.
Okay. We have in hand Dr. Abudu's testimony. We have documents. We have some letters. I believe, and I do not wish to misrepresent, so I have to say I believe, that we have a copy of the Ghanaian newspaper with headlines, number one about Hamidu being declared number one enemy and a price on his head.
Could you have put that in your original motion?
We did not have it. It took us 2 months to get the evidence. We were searching on three continents in order to meet our prima facie entry level of evidence. We did receive affidavits, and we were able to get the affidavits. We got materials from England. This did not come in, and this is one reason that it took 2 months to get the case together. We were waiting to try to get that.
Your time has expired, Ms. Harper.
Thank you.
Mr. Klonoff, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Ultimately, as Justices Scalia and O'Connor recognized, the issue is whether the BIA must reopen because of a new fact, whether it is compelled to. Now, the BIA accepts the fact that the visit occurred, and the question is whether or not that fact is so significant that the BIA must give compelling weight to it. And the reason that we're arguing that the BIA should be given leeway in making these judgments is, number one, because of the expertise that it has in reviewing thousands of cases, an expertise, in fact, recognized in Cardozo-Fonseca in the decision, making clear that there's a difference between a straight question of statutory interpretation and a question of applying the law to the facts of the particular case. I believe it's slip opinion, page 26. And finally, the greatest deference of all, because in this situation, as counsel concedes, Congress did not specify that reopening had to be required in any situation whatsoever. And for that reason, we would submit a particular degree of deference should be given to the board. Consequently, unless there are any further questions, we would urge that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Klonoff. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number